Tickles and Giggles with Tiff Box, and the Widowed Parent Organization. All that on this episode of...
Snobby Snobby.
Yeah.
Healthy Schmelty.
Yeah.
Healthy Schmelty.
Yeah.
Well, hey there, and welcome to the public health podcast, Healthy Schmelty. I'm Rishi B, your public health MC. A quick note that music for today's episode is courtesy Granddaddy, the indie rock band from California. The song you just heard is called Elevate Myself, and Granddaddy has great albums like Under the Western Freeway and Just Like the Family Cat on Spotify, YouTube, and all the streaming services. I have to take a moment right now, actually, to thank Granddaddy for their awesome song AM 180, which is on that 28 Days Later movie, that zombie movie, which is excellent. And I also have to thank them, actually, for introducing me to Electric Light Orchestra through their cover song Shangri-La, which first got me into ELO. You know what? Let's all take a moment right now to send our love and appreciation to the person or people who first introduced us to ELO. Anyway, you can find links to Granddaddy's music at the show notes for this episode at rishibee.com. That's rishibee.com. Or you can go to bit.ly/schmelty. All right, listener, what do you say we start this thing? But what is this thing, you may be asking yourself? Well, you know what? Keeping everything straight with healthcare can be pretty complicated. And so that's why I decided to use my Master's of Public Health and years of experience in healthcare to create this here little podcast, Healthy Schmelty, in order to demystify the perplexities of healthcare and help you be a little bit more informed on your well-being one episode at a time. Coming up on this episode, I talk with Dr. Justin Yap of the University of North Carolina's Comprehensive Cancer Support Program. He's also co-author of the book, The Group, Seven Widowed Parents Reimagine Life. That book, The Group, is about a support program UNC's Cancer Center started to help widowed parents and their families through their loss of a spouse or parent. UNC's Cancer Center started this program themselves once they saw there wasn't much in resources available to widowed parents, and their book, The Group, is in support of that. But first, let's introduce my friend, improv comedian, and podcaster Tiffany to the show. In this segment, we talk all things comedy, and it's called, appropriately, Tickles and Giggles with Tiff Box. Hey everyone, I'm here with my friend Tiffany Boxy. It's another edition of Tickles and Giggles with Tiff Box.
I love it.
Yeah. I was quite proud of myself when I thought of that.
Very cute.
Tiffany and I, we share being in comedy together. Tiffany is a improv comedian. Improviser. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Improviser.
It's okay. And, improv comedian sounds like fancier, though. I like it.
Okay. Yeah. You know, suggest that to the improv world.
Is, yes.
You know, to get a title change. See if you can get a promotion for a title change.
Yeah, right. Again, we don't get paid. So.
And I invited her today to talk about some comedy. You know, I'm super into comedy, and I know Tiffany is as well. And we love talking about it. And so here we go. Let's just get right into it. So Tiffany, we were chatting a little bit earlier today because you had tagged me in a Facebook comment about some updates that are happening to this What We Do in the Shadows
yes.
movie, but now there's mm-hmm. a show. But why don't I let you talk about like why this came up for you in recently?
Okay, yeah. Well, first of all, I'm very excited that I was right in you knowing what the movie was, even if you're not as excited about the TV show as I am. But the movie was incredible, and I'm so glad that finally Network picked up on the TV show, because we need good comedy on TV again. Like, right, fucking absolutely. Finally. Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, luckily, like, Modern Family and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia are still going strong, but still, right. like, it's not, you know, we need new shit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but it's funny, because... I'm dating an improviser as well, and you would think that if two people are in improv, students especially, they have the same sense of humor, and we don't, and we're slowly starting to learn that. And so the other day we were just hanging out, and he pulls out his laptop, and he wanted to watch something on it. And he just, out of nowhere, he just found What We Do in the Shadows on Amazon Prime. I didn't even know that he had heard of it or knew what it was or anything. And every time, like, we mentioned comedians or mentioned movies or whatever, neither of us had really seen what the other one had seen. We're like, oh, man, okay, we'll figure out something, like, something. And then so he starts watching it, and I'm like, have you seen this movie before? And he's like, no, but I'm only a few minutes into it, and I thought I'd pick back up on it, and it's hilarious. I'm like, I saw it in the theater, and I loved it. Oh, my gosh. And he's like, what? And we watched the entire thing, and he's laughing so hard, like, in the parts that I was laughing at. Like, it was just, it was great, like, watching someone watch something that you like,
right.
but you're not forcing him to watch it, you know?
I love that.
Yeah, so that was, like, really exciting for me. I'm like, we do have the same kind of humor. We just haven't found it yet.
Yeah.
So now we're, like, trying to go through this list of, like, you know, Amazon, Netflix, and all that. They'll tell you, like, oh, if you liked this, you'll like these other things. So now we're trying to figure out more things that we can watch. And maybe if we ever do improv together, we can kind of figure out a style that we can perform at together and like all this stuff. So it's like really cool when you find that other weird person, you know?
So yeah,
it's
right.
really great.
It's definitely a weird movie. And just to
it's kind so of weird.
Set up in case anyone doesn't know or hasn't seen it. So I just Googled it, and the genre is horror/comedy horror. This is one of those movies that I feel like is really hard to kind of classify something. It's definitely comedy, though.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know, it's kind of a fake reality show about vampire housemates. So all the people living in this house are vampires, and it stars Jermaine Clement and Taika, I think it's pronounced Taika Waititi.
Mm-hmm.
So there, Taika Waititi is the director of Thor Ragnarok most recently.
Hmm.
So that was pretty cool. And for those of you who are fans of that movie, he was the guy who played the rock character, the guy who is made of rocks.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the cast is going to stay the same. It seems like no one else had like other projects and stuff, just from what I've been reading. So I hope that it not only has everyone, but also is good.
So make sure you look out for that, everyone. FX, I think it's FX. Yeah, FX TV show, What We Do in the Shadows. Make sure you watch it. It brought Tiffany closer to her boyfriend.
Yeah, I realized that I actually like him a lot more watching that. Like, we didn't have anything to talk about for weeks. We were just silent with our laptops next to each other, you know, with our headphones on.
Yeah.
And then finally we found something, and now we're in love.
So. Aw, it was very cold and dreary. And then all
it
of a sudden,
so
when you laughed,
and dark and
when you watch that, and all of a sudden the sun was shining. Yeah.
Thank you, Flight of the Conchords, and What We Do in the Shadows, for making us closer than ever. I appreciate you guys.
let's go on to the next item. Okay, so talking about like hot button issues, let's move on to the next one that I wanted to talk about.
Yes.
Dave Chappelle's recent stand-up sets, they're all on Netflix, and the two in particular that are causing a lot of buzz are called Deep in the Heart of Texas and The Bird Revelation. What are your thoughts, Tiffany, on some of the buzz that's been going around these?
He's one of those people that like is like why a lot of other Americans kind of suck, I guess. Like he wants to make some things an issue and then some things not. And like, it just depends on kind of what he's feeling. That's just what it seems like what he wants to talk about, like what will be funny, what will get a reaction out of people. Like,
right.
This is what I do. This is how I've made my career. How do I either offend people or just get people talking? And that's just what he wants to do. And I don't understand like where he's at with anything almost.
Okay.
Except that he just hates the world. Which I guess is a lot of...
A good friend of mine, mm-hmm. he puts Dave Chappelle at the top, and we always have arguments about where mm-hmm. Dave Chappelle should be, but mm-hmm. after seeing these recent ones, mm-hmm. I put him at the top of my list, too.
Mm-hmm. I love him as a comedian. Like, yeah. I think he's great. He's a great storyteller. He yeah. has, like, that stage presence that, like, people have to, like, work years to get. Like, he right. is incredible, but he's also, like, a piece of shit, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, so...
I don't know. But I guess they all are, right?
I think mm-hmm. he kind of rides the line between, like, kind of being absurd and telling mm-hmm. the truth.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he just has this thing. And I, you know, despite all the buzz that you may have seen or, you know, read, I would highly recommend watching mm-hmm. or listening to Deep in the Heart of Texas and The Bird Revelation, because they're just very unique comedy sets. Like, there's very, like you were saying, Tiffany, there's very few people who have that kind of presence that he has. Mm-hmm. He had this thing in earlier comedy about not being too preachy, mm-hmm. in my opinion. He comes off, I think this is where you were getting at, Tiffany, that he comes off a little preachy, more recently, but.
Yeah.
You can't really tell where he's coming from. He's just like preaching at you.
Kind of. Right, yeah. Maybe because he feels like he has to, like, because he has the mic and he knows people are listening. Like, I'm not sure. And it's not like I don't necessarily like what he's saying.
Yeah.
It can just be like a little like, yeah, the other comedians are doing that too. Like, you don't really have to. You have your own thing. Like, embrace that, you know?
Yeah. So, and just to kind of explain what's going on here is, he also made a comment about how basically the accusers, who brought out all the allegations against Louis C.K., that they should keep in mind that their problems aren't as bad as being enslaved. So, you know, he makes these kind of things, and I don't agree with them, but... You know, he also made a point later that, like, towards the end of The Bird Revelation, that comedians have a responsibility to speak recklessly. So I think that's the thing that he values above all else is just saying things for the sake of saying them. I don't know. Do you think comedians have a responsibility
no.
as far as, like, moral stuff or things like that?
I mean... I guess that's, like, a tricky question, because, like, we always want entertainers to be...
entertaining.
...something that they're not, or something that we just wish that they could be, I guess. And that is unfair to us, you know, to, like, put that on them, because we're getting entertained regardless, right? So why do they have to give a message or give a moral of the story, you know, like...
Yeah.
That shouldn't be on them to do that, like... It's almost like you're telling them how to write the comedy. It's like, right. No, don't do that. Like, then just don't go to their show.
I value having been able to hear Dave Chappelle say what he said and arguing about it online as opposed to not having that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I really do want to listen to more of, like, his stuff, you know, to really, like, make an opinion. Because I'm just like... just annoyed of everyone, I think, right now. And, like,
yeah.
I don't want to be that person, but I'm just like, ugh, everyone just sucks. And, like, you know.
Yo, 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 yo.
The Louis C.K. thing, I have to say, that, like, totally hit me, like, really hard. Because he was a guy that I, like, really looked up to.
Mm-hmm. And, shit.
Yeah, yeah. And because I suspect that Louis C.K. will be back. You know, mm-hmm. with stand-up. Yeah. But mm-hmm. then it's, like, on me, like, do I...
Are you going to watch it?
Support it? Yeah.
Right.
Does it make me a bad person if I do choose to support, you know, go see his comedy?
Right. Yeah. I actually had a conversation with another improviser, like actor, about this kind of thing recently, like when the Aziz Ansari stuff like was coming out. And it's easy to say like, oh, I'm not going to support these people, based on like my beliefs and like this person's a shit person, so I don't want to support them by giving them my money, blah, blah, blah. And I feel like I've kind of gotten to that point where if it's convenient for me, yes, I've done it. Like, I didn't go see the new Woody Allen movie that came out in 2016.
Oh, okay.
I haven't listened to a Chris Brown album in a very long time. Like, I went to his concerts, like, when I was 19, 20, like, before all of that stuff happened.
Okay.
I haven't since then, you know, but at the same time, I will watch anything that James Franco will do because I like him. Mm-hmm. Even though I know he's kind of a shit person, like, mm-hmm. even after he found out that girl on Instagram was, like, 15, he was still trying to talk to her, like, no, like, you're a shit, like, you know,
yeah.
But for some reason, I will still watch his movies, like,
yeah.
So I'm kind of a shit person, too, for, like, picking and choosing, you know,
well,
like,
you know,
I don't know.
All... See, this is the thing that kind of gets me, is we're all shit people, you know, we're all partly shit people,
mm-hmm.
And but some of us, like, you know, Kevin Spacey, Louis C.K., Harvey Weinstein,
yeah.
we're people
mm-hmm.
who are shittier than other
mm-hmm.
people,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, and Kevin Spacey is actually, like, my favorite actor of all time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, since, like, 95, like, I just appreciated cinema, like, so much when I saw The Usual Suspects. And I know I was only, like, 8 years old, but I'm like, fuck yeah.
yeah.
I want to make movies or I want to be in movies because of this movie, you know?
Right.
And, like, he was the main character in it. So, obviously, everyone was good, but he was, like, the one that sold it. And I was
for
like,
sure.
I love
yeah.
him. And then, like, Seven and The Life of David Gale and, like, all these things. Like, he's just incredible and I love him.
Yeah.
I'm like, there's no way. He's, like, he's always kind of been old, like, since I was a kid, you know? Like, he's always just been an old guy.
Yeah.
You
right.
know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, nothing bad can happen. Like, whatever. And
right.
it's actually kind of cool that, like, he's not, like, sleeping around with, like, all these, like, other Hollywood actresses. Like, he's been in movies with some, like, babes. And, like, you know, he's not that kind of person. That's awesome. Like, he doesn't
right.
have four divorces under his belt and blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, oh, fuck. He could
yeah.
still be a shit person, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Ugh, so that
yeah.
really sucks.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it just comes down to, I think kind of what you were saying is everyone kind of has to draw the lines for
mm-hmm.
themselves.
Yeah.
See, I get gas when I watch a Woody Allen movie. But, and I get gas, you know, watching The Cosby Show.
Oh,
you know,
yeah. I don't watch that anymore.
When
ugh,
I say gas, I fart when I when I attempt to watch a Woody Allen movie. But
well, farting is actually a good thing. So now I'm confused with where you stand. Because,
yeah,
like,
right.
farting
it
is a release.
So funny.
And, you know, you feel good after.
Yeah. Well, okay. And so I think that's a good place to end it, you know, on farting. We're not going to solve any problems, societal problems,
yeah.
just now. Mm-hmm. But I think we all appreciate Tiffany tickling and giggling with you. Having been tickled and giggling with the fuck. Okay, so that's been Talking Comedy with Tickles and Giggles with TiffBox. Many thanks to Tiffany for joining me, and listeners, make sure you follow at Baxinator. That's at Baxinator on Twitter. You can listen to her podcast, Chai Tea Party, and if you're local to Michigan, to Southeast Michigan, make sure to follow her on Twitter to find out when you can see her perform improv. If you have any comments on Dave Chappelle or the moral responsibility of comedians, make sure you email me, therishib@gmail.com, or use the comment form at rishib.com or bit.ly/schmelty. Now let's talk about the Widowed Parent Organization. Dr. Justin Yap with the Lindberger Comprehensive Cancer Center and Associate Professor and Department of Psychiatry Psychologist at UNC joins me on the podcast now. Dr. Justin Yap is co-author of the book, The Group, Seven Widowed Parents Reimagine Life, about a support program started at UNC to help widowed parents and their families through their loss of a spouse or parent. The audio starts with Justin talking about the creation of the Widowed Parent Organization and the story behind the book, The Group, which was started when seven women undergoing care at UNC's Cancer Center all unfortunately passed away from cancer relatively recent to each other, leaving their families behind.
That actually came about because we had several young mothers who we were working with who had all passed away around the same time. And we got to thinking about their husbands and realized that there was just a real dearth of information and support. So we decided to fill that gap. So we started the program, and it's we run a support group separately, one for mothers, one for fathers. We have a website called widowedparent.org that provides resources. We have a series of videos featuring some of the people who have been in our support groups. And we just released a book about the first support group we ran for widowed fathers called The Group, Seven Widowed Fathers Reimagine Life.
Okay. So the Widowed Parent Organization is part of the UNC Cancer Center?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. So it's a little outside of the traditional mission of the cancer hospital, but our leadership has been great in supporting us because they, I think, realize that this has been an unmet need. And if you're a widowed parent and you're looking for any kind of information or resources that are specific to what, you know, you may be going through, there's just not much out there for you. So we're hoping to add to that.
Sure. So let's touch a little bit on what you're talking about, how you and some of your colleagues noticed a gap. Let's talk about what life was like before the organization, before some of the more current understanding. So how was grief being handled before?
Well, that's, certainly extends beyond our program and just kind of in our society at large. I think that what most of us understand about grief is maybe a little bit outdated and not quite what it should be. I think there's a lot of people. In fact, what we hear about a lot is that people have at least some kind of passing familiarity with the five stages of grief, the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model from the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And that's just kind of been ingrained in our culture, and most people at least kind of have some understanding that that's how grief progresses. And that's quite simply just kind of not how it works. There's not really much or any research to support that people pass through sequential stages or even go through any stages at all. I think grief is much, much more dynamic and much more individualistic than that.
Can you elaborate a little bit on Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief? Is that the denial?
Right. Okay. And so that actually came from, to kind of set the stage back in the 1960s and before. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a whole lot of talk about, grief and death and dying. And she was a psychiatrist in Chicago, and she worked with a lot of patients who were dying of, different illnesses. And back then it was even kind of the norm that the doctors wouldn't even tell the patients what they had or that they had a terminal diagnosis. And that's kind of, where our culture was 50, 60 years ago. And so
sure.
She observed, I think, about 250 of her patients who were dying, and through her clinical observations kind of found these five stages that people go through and wrote a book about it, and had an article in Life magazine that kind of catapulted her and her understanding of grief into the national consciousness, because there was just such a void.
Sure.
There wasn't a whole lot, people weren't talking about it. No one really understood it. So what she proposed about how people grieve the loss, their own anticipated death, kind of came to be known as how people grieve any loss of any kind. And there's just been very, very little research to support that. And there's been Different other models that have been proposed since then. And over the years, our team has become really fond of a model called the dual process model of coping and bereavement by a couple of psychologists in the Netherlands, Strobe and Schoot. So I don't know if you want me to talk more about that, but that's really a model that we've found works extremely well with the parents who we work with.
Sure. Yeah. If you wouldn't mind, since you brought that up, talking about the dual process model.
Yeah. And so again, it's called the dual process model of coping and bereavement. And there's been some data behind that. It's still mostly conceptual, but there is some data to support it. And the way it instead of kind of categorizing how you should feel or, you know, emotions that you experience or progress through or any kind of grieving task that you must, you know, accomplish to reach, you know, a state of healing. What it does is it categorizes different stressors that people go through in two different bins, loss-oriented stressors and restoration-oriented stressors. And so the loss-oriented stressors are those things that we would typically think about grief, right? So, you know, I things that you miss that you no longer have, such as, you know, you're yearning for the person you lost, you're you know, missing in terms of widowed parent, you lost the co-parent, you lost someone that was helping you with the children.
Okay.
You know, every time an anniversary comes up or the death date comes up, you think back to all that was lost. So it's kind of a backward looking of all that was lost. And the other one is restoration oriented stressors. And that's things that you do to restore your life moving forward. So for our widowed parents, that's, you know, learning to do the parenting responsibilities that their spouse did, you know, figuring out, you know, how to meal plan or how to sign the kids up for, you know, summer camps or, you know, any of the kind of, you know, things that we might take for granted when there's two spouses around.
Sure.
And so the way that the people go through this is that you kind of oscillate. You go back and forth between looking back and then moving forward and looking back and moving forward. And that's a natural thing. And sometimes you'll oscillate, you know, within the same, you know, hour or within this, you know, kind of same experience. And then over time that attenuates. And healthy grieving is looking back a little bit less over time and, you know, more of kind of the solidification of the restoration process, you know, as you move ahead. And so it doesn't tell you what you should feel or how long you should feel it or any kind of order of, you know, emotions that you have to experience. It really just helps kind of categorize and give you a framework for understanding the looking back and moving forward process. And it's really one that we, you know, kind of read about. It's not, I don't think it's all that well known, but at least not in popular culture. But once we learned about it and studied it, we've become big fans of it.
Not to make light, but you talked about which model has, you know, kind of permeated through culture. And the five stages of grief, I very clearly remember an episode of The Simpsons where they talked about the five episodes of grief.
It's everywhere. When we were writing our book, we were, you know, thinking about this and looking back and looking at how widely it has permeated society. And, you know, we found articles about, you know, when LeBron James left the Cleveland Cavaliers years ago, there was a whole article in the Cleveland paper about how the fans were going through the five stages of grief. And so it's really kind of everywhere and anywhere. And even if people don't have a great understanding of what the model suggests, what I think people do take away from it is that there are stages.
Yeah.
And that's, we don't think that's a very accurate or very helpful way to look at a person's grief.
Yeah. Actually, just in support of that, I was going through the Widowed Parent website and I was listening to a video that was talking about how grief can be kind of spontaneous. And there was a story, a mother whose spouse passed away, and she's just kind of trying to go through her day, you know, with the spouse gone. And then she's driving on her way back home from work, and she hears a song on the radio that reminds her of her spouse. And I think that's kind of true. Like, grief isn't, like, you know, it's not something you can schedule. It's just kind of spontaneous.
No, that's absolutely right. And we hear those kind of stories all the time in our support groups. And in our book, we, you know, sprinkle in those kind of stories and vignettes about what the fathers told us. And just what you're describing, actually, one of the guys in our first group who's in the book, Bruce, said that, he was having a good day and he was kind of feeling good about where he was. And just as you describe, a song came on the radio.
Oh, okay.
And he had to pull over on the side of the road. He was crying so hard and just kind of hit him out of the blue. And by that point, he was far enough out that he kind of had his moment and had his cry and kind of wiped his tears. And 10 minutes later was kind of back on the road and feeling okay. A real harmful, I think, idea is that people, you know, either get over this or should be past this.
Right.
And we certainly hear that a lot, that parents who we work with either have interactions with others or at least perceive from others that, you know, there's this expectation that it's been, you know, X amount of time. Shouldn't you be past this now?
Sure.
Or it's been X amount of time. You know, shouldn't you take off your ring now? Or all these kind of things that suggest that you get over it. And, you know, what we've found is that, you know, these parents that we work with don't really necessarily kind of move on from their grief, right? You don't move on as if like you kind of put it behind you, but you learn to move forward with. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a subtle but an important difference.
So let's get to the creation of the Widowed Parent Organization. So you mentioned the study with the seven fathers, but I was wondering, was there a specific incident or was there someone who came to someone who was with UNC that kind of led to the creation of the organization?
Yeah, so it actually came out during a morning meeting one day when we were in the hospital talking about, you know, with my colleague and co-author Don Rosenstein and Lisa Park and others. We were talking about, you know, we always every week talk about patients that are either difficult or interesting or that we kind of need to discuss to kind of get some help on. And we had had a tragically several young mothers who we had come to know who had terminal cancer. And sadly, they all did die and they all passed away around the same time. And so we got talking in one of these meetings about just kind of what their husbands, who we had come to know a little bit, what they must be going through. And I actually went to Googled, you know, local support groups for widowed parents to kind of refer these guys. And with the false expectation that there were such, you know, support groups that were that specific. And what we found were that there was nothing local, or we couldn't find on the internet really anything anywhere specific to being a widowed parent. And so we saw that as a real void and decided to kind of throw our hat in the ring and start a support group. So we started a support group and we wrangled up these men who we had known and some of which we had just kind of spread the word out and had heard about it. Our plan was to do six sessions. We had it all worked out. We were going to have six sessions and each session was going to be us kind of leading a didactic for the first part and kind of teaching about some aspect of widowed parenthood. And then the second half would be group discussion. And so that was the plan. And then we had our first meeting and we had these guys together and we heard their stories when they introduced themselves one after another. It was just brutal. All these men were going through how lost they felt, the responsibility of now being their child's only parent. By the end of that meeting, the guys had started to connect and started to talk with each other and share experiences, and there was a sense of community just by the end of that first meeting. And so we kind of thought, you know what, maybe this group discussion is a lot more valuable than anything we thought we had to teach you guys. So we changed that. And then one of the dads said, well, why are we only doing six sessions? And we didn't have a great answer. So we decided to keep it open-ended. And this group of men met together for nearly 4 years.
Wow.
Which is a lot longer than we had anticipated. And it turned into a really special group. These men were there for each other in ways that no one else could be.
Sure.
And in turn, they helped us build the program. They helped us build the first website. They helped us with some academic papers that we had published. They were our content experts. They read over these papers and gave us feedback. we started a research study, and we kind of asked them if we were looking at the right issues and asking the right questions, and they helped us out that way. We started to get some publicity around it a little bit, and they were, you know, participants with us with several media appearances, and that was really turned out to be part of their healing, was to give back to others by helping us build and sustain this program. Yeah. And so it really was focused on fathers, but more recently we've expanded our focus, and we're really happy to have done this, to look at all parents, mothers and fathers, regardless of how their spouses or partners died. And so yeah, now we have this new website, widowedparent.org. Mm-hmm. And we're hopeful that, you know, through means such as your podcast, that widow parents will hear about this and decide to go to it and at least get some modicum of support and comfort by seeing and hearing the videos of other men talk about their experiences. And it's also the main reason why we wrote the book. So we were so inspired by these seven guys and what they meant to each other, and how they really were able to recreate and re-envision their lives, that they allowed us and really encouraged us to write their story. And so we didn't know what to call the book, and we finally just kind of called it what we always call these men, and that was just the group. That's kind of what they were, and we really got to know these guys, and they've been really great partners with us.
And you were saying how you and your colleagues at the Cancer Center were kind of discussing these gentlemen. Were you already aware of the dual process model at that point?
Great question.
Okay.
No, we weren't at all. We were, you know, what we do in our day jobs is, you know, what I do in my day job is I'm a, you know, clinical psychologist, and I meet with people who are, you know, coping with their own cancer, or family members who are struggling to cope with their family member having cancer. So we were not squarely in the bereavement realm at all.
Sure. So I'm kind of curious what observations the Widowed Parent Organization has made throughout the course of, you know, starting off with those seven fathers to now. So can you talk a little bit about how children process grief differently than adults?
Yeah, so that's in our work, in our support group, what we do is we, you know, we meet with the parents, and then what we do have is we have actually student athletes from Carolina come over, and they just play with the kids in a room down the hall. So we have a thing, we didn't want parents to not be able to come to the meeting because they didn't have childcare, didn't have a babysitter. So,
right.
So that's what the kids do. So we don't actually do, you know, kind of direct grief, you know, counseling with the kids. But what we can tell you about from what the parents say is that, you know, there's, you know, it really runs the gamut, right? Like we see and we hear about kids who are, you know, really struggle in the immediate aftermath of losing a parent. And we see kids, we hear about kids who seem to do, you know, a lot better than the parents would expect. And we hear a lot from the parents about how they're surprised with how resilient their kids are. Mm-hmm. But then we also do hear about, you know, kids who seem to do fine and maybe doing fine for a period of time, but then at some point down the road, either because they've gotten older and have a different understanding, or because they've kind of kept it together for dad's sake for so long and dad seems to be doing better, so now maybe they can kind of have their moment. Or a certain Mother's Day comes along and that kind of brings it about, is that, you know, there's what we see and hear about a lot is because it's kind of delayed grief from kids, right? That they kind of seem to do okay, and they may be doing okay, for a while, but then that doesn't necessarily mean that they're okay and that they're going to, you know, that they're kind of past it or over it or whatever. I mean, it can hit kids differently, and it can hit them in a delayed manner. You kind of noticed a little bit of a pattern or a little bit of a theme in that there seems to be, you know, some grief around like what these dads that we mainly work with, what these dads can't do that their mothers used to do. And that often involves little things like decorating for Christmas or cooking a certain meal or things that that maybe they can't do that their wives could once do, and that was kind of in their realm, and that's somewhere somehow where some of this grief comes about.
You're saying the children identified them those things themselves.
Yeah.
That mom used to
do
this. Oh wow.
Yeah, like, you know, like, do you remember when mom used to make this? Or sometimes even in frustration, like, well, mom used to do this. And you know, that's very understandable, and their lives have been turned upside down too. And then certainly once the people we work with, once they're interested and start dating again, that can bring about all kinds of conflicting emotions with the kids. And we, you know, this one child said, you know, he found it profoundly unfair that his father got to, select a new wife, but he didn't get to get a new mom. And you know, you can have more than one wife in your lifetime. You can't have more than one mom. At least that's how this child felt. And if they start wanting to date again, and if they get serious and wanted to think about marrying, one of the guys in our group said when he was 20, he was, you know, trying to find someone that he wanted to be with. It was like solving a jigsaw puzzle. It was just a matter of finding the right fit. And it was two dimensional. It wasn't, you know, it was hard, but it wasn't that hard. But with kids, it was like solving a Rubik's Cube, right? There's many more sides. It's three-dimensional. It's really hard. You know there's a solution, but it's not nearly as easy.
So what does the bottom look like? Like, what does improper handling of grief, improper coping, like, what are you risking by not properly handling your grief?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I don't know what kind of the best answer is. It's, you know, and I would even hate to say kind of, you know, improper, because, you know, I wouldn't want to say that, you know, you're grieving inaccurately. It's right. Yeah, but you know, I think if you go back to the dual process model, if you think the work of grief in a sense is to kind of go back and forth between, you know, looking back and kind of processing what was lost and moving forward and restoring the future. I think if you get stuck in either one of those, it can be hard. So okay, if you just spend all your time looking back, that's probably not healthy. And if you spend all your time just looking forward without kind of processing what was lost, that's probably not healthy either. And that's certainly true with these, you know, parents we work with, right? You can't afford to spend all day in bed because you got to get your kid on the bus. You got to, you know, you're now the only person getting any income, so you probably still have to figure out how to go to work, and then you got to feed your kids at night, and you got to sign all the forms from school in the evening, and you got to pay the bill. And so, as overwhelming as that is, it makes it hard to just sulk in the backward looking process. Healthy grieving, the way they answer that question is, healthy grieving is doing both, looking back and restoring the future.
I'd love to get your thoughts on what's missing as far as kind of the system. So are there certain actions or resources you'd like to see the government kind of provide for grieving parents? Do you think there's a role there?
Well, yeah, I think the quick answer is absolutely. I think the larger context of that is that more resources into mental health are needed. And
for sure.
You know, that's probably a whole nother podcast. you know, as part of healthcare reform, at least what's been floated, and not to get too deep in the weeds, but what was passed by the House last year would have really cut mental health funding. Mm-hmm. And we see in all kinds of ways, we see in dramatic ways, really more topically with the recent shooting in Florida, that's kind of brought up a need for mental health services availability for certainly, you know, a much wider population than grieving parents. But so that's the big answer, is that we need more mental health funding and more of a priority on that
for sure.
In a broader sense. And as far as for widowed parents, yeah, we see an absolute need for, and really an absolute opening for these kind of support programs to pop up anywhere. And that's really our fantasy and our vision, is that what we've done here will pop up at either cancer centers or bereavement centers all over the country. And I don't Right. say that to say that there aren't already some that are doing that. Mm-hmm. I think that there probably are, but it's, as far as a group specific to widowed parents, and really not even necessarily tied into how their kids are doing, but just more focused on them. We don't think there's probably enough of those. Sure. And there should be, and it's not even a high cost, you know, really the only cost that we do, we don't charge for the group. You know, Don and I don't get paid extra for doing it. The only cost are, you know, buying pizza and drinks for the group members once a month. That's really about it, right? You got a place to do it. We do it off the hospital grounds because understandably a lot of people don't want to come back to the hospital where their spouses were treated. But
sure.
we do that. You know, it really doesn't cost that much. I mean, pizza and drinks for the year cost about $1,000. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty low financial burden for what we've seen to be a really helpful resource for these parents.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of frustrating, and I know it sounds like you could relate. In the almost 10 years I've been involved in healthcare, mental health, behavioral health, it's always been a thing like, oh yeah, someone should do something about that. And that's kind of where it's been stuck at, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of people see it in the health realm per se, right? Like, you know, that kind of is something that happens to other people, or, you know, anyone can break their arm, or anyone can get, you know, an illness, but I'm not someone who's going to be that depressed, or I'm not someone who's psychotic, or that's kind of another people's problem.
Right. Rounding things off, on the website, one thing that I noticed, I think it can be helpful, parents, the widowed parents, just seeing something or hearing something stated can be helpful.
Yeah,
because I see on the website that things are broken out by parent and children and what stage of grief that you're at. So I wonder if just seeing something written out on the website can be really helpful for a parent. One thing that I saw in there, though, was the concept of there not being a perfect parent.
Right.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that? Do we suffer from this thinking that parents are perfect?
Well, yeah. So what we quote and get into a little more in depth in the book is kind of this idea floated by a psychoanalyst decades ago named Donald Winnicott, who put forth the notion that parents don't need to be perfect. In fact, being perfect for your kids and meeting their every need is actually not helpful. Kids need to learn how to some degree, deal with adversity and not having everything done for them. And that, in fact, being the perfect parent isn't desirable, but being the good enough parent is.
Sure.
And so that's a notion that when we, you know, kind of floated that to the people in the group, I think offered some relief and really kind of struck a chord, because, you know, these, you know, if you're a widowed mom or a widowed dad, you're not going to be the perfect parent. You certainly weren't before. Right. And, you know, you're sure as heck not going to be now. And we hear one story after another about, you know, parents kind of dropping the ball. And we write about some of those in our book. You know, just a couple come to one comes to mind right now. We had one guy who was just overwhelmed with all the responsibilities and his own grief and his helping his kids grieve. And maybe a few months, maybe 6 months into after his wife had passed, he was sitting at the dinner table with his three daughters and noticed that one of them had a brand new pair of shoes and thought, I don't remember buying those shoes. So he asked his daughter, you know, where'd you get those shoes? And his daughter was kind of even reluctant to say at first because she didn't want to make him feel bad, but he pressed, and she said, she acknowledged that her fourth grade teacher actually bought them for her at school, went out during the lunch period and bought her some new shoes. And he said, well, why, you know, why would she do that? And she said, well, because my old ones were flapping around, they were worn down to the sole, and she heard me kind of flapping in the hallway. And he said, well, why didn't you tell me? And she's like, Dad, I did. I've told you like three times. And And he felt terrible, right? His kid's walking around with a dilapidated shoe, and she had told him, and he believed her, it had just gone in one ear and out the other, or just fallen off the list of things that he was able to manage and do. Right. And so he felt terrible, and, like, you know, imagined what people at the school were thinking about him as a parent. Thankfully, in the group setting, he could tell it in a way and kind of get some good nature ribbing from the other guys, in a way that I think kind of diffused the guilt that he had laid on himself. But we heard those kind of stories. I mean, you know, we could have written a separate book just for those.
For sure. Well, just rounding things off, can you tell people the website and the book?
Absolutely. Again? Yeah. So the website is widowedparent.org, and the book. And so the website is really for widowed parents as a resource. The book we wrote certainly, I think, would be, you know, very relevant to any widowed parent, but we wrote it for a much broader audience, and it really speaks to kind of grief and adaptation and resiliency on the whole through the story of these seven men who joined our first support group. So the name of the book is The Group, Seven Widowed Fathers Reimagine Life. And it tells the true story of these seven men and how they healed and how that can be helpful to anyone going through a difficult time. Any proceeds that we make from the book go back to our program. So Don and I, my co-author and I, we're not making any money off this. It's kind of, you know, it's these father's stories. We're just the ones that are sharing them.
That does it for this episode. Thanks everyone for listening, and many thanks to Dr. Justin Yap for coming on. If you know of a family that suffered the loss of a parent and can use healing, make sure to refer them to the Widowed Parent Organization's website, widowedparent.org, or make sure you refer them to the book The Group. Many thanks to Tiffany for coming on for Tickles and Giggles with Tiffbox, and once again, you can find them, their podcast, Chai Tea Party, and their improv shows at Baxinator. That's Baxinator. And many thanks again to Granddaddy for their music. Find links to their music and new album, Last Place, at the show notes for this episode at rishib.com or bit.ly/schmelty. If you have any comments, make sure to email me, therishib@gmail.com, or use the comment form at rishib.com. or bit.ly/schmelty. Thank you, listener, for your listening. Hope you're feeling healthier and maybe, just maybe, even a little healthy schmeltier.